At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Millennial Money. We're super excited today to talk about this crazy shift in the stock market and some movements, especially in meme stocks. We're going to be talking about those. But first, we want to remind you about Webull in the link down below, our Millennial Money Clips channel also in the link down below, and a very special message from Graham.
Yay! So I just want to mention this here first, and Kevin, I got to give you an update on this too. A week ago, I reached out to Kevin and I asked him a question if he wanted his own coffee for sale at BankrollCoffee.com, and we would donate the proceeds of that to your campaign. So I'm really excited to announce that labels are being printed right now. We're getting the photography ready later this week. So I want to say, like, by the end of the week, hopefully we should have that ready for sale at BankrollCoffee.com.
Nice.
Woo-hoo. Thank you, Graham.
So, Jeremy, awesome.
You're yeah. Next. And if you haven't got to check out the Hungry Bowl, make sure you download it. We're now on iOS and Android. That's a way to track your stocks, track your cryptos, do some research on stocks, listen to earnings calls, and we got so much more coming, including Dark Mode, which I think is an update that's coming tonight, I believe. So definitely check out the Hungry Bowl. I'll kick it over to Andre.
Wow. I've just been promoting Kevin on my Instagram. I'm sending everybody a message that I know lives in California. I'm like, go vote for Kevin. And I got a few people, and I think the web's going to spread. But other than that, I'm putting out a magic course where you can learn how to do card tricks. It's going to be awesome.
Do that again.
No, I'm just kidding.
Do that again for the retention.
I got excited.
These are called isolations, and they're pretty cool.
Wow.
Isn't that sick? Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Cool.
Tricks are for kids. What's up? So no,
wait.
You can actually
can you do it again now.
Well, do it again.
All right. Go, monkey, go. wait. This is called cylinder, and it looked like this. I'm not warmed
Whoa.
Up, but it's called the worm because it looks like the worm. This is called the thumb propulsion technique. Kind of looks like this. Took me forever to learn all that. And here's a fun one called L cuts. I don't know why they're called L cuts, but I don't know if you can tell. And then I don't know if you guys have seen people shuffle in the casino. They probably shuffle like this. You've seen it, right?
Yeah.
With cardistry, you can actually do that with one hand. Let's see if I can do it. See if it can focus on my hand instead of my face.
Whoa.
What? Yeah, anyway, that's not what I'm promoting at all. I'm actually here to talk about my Patreon, which you can find in the link down below where you can plug in your stocks into the spreadsheet. And if you're a dividend investor and you'll have passive income, it tells you exactly how much you're going to get paid, when you get paid, your diversification across sectors. And it's a lot of fun stuff. So anyway, that's down below.
That was cool. Do
if I sign up for that, will you do a magic trick, Andre? Because that was amazing.
I will personally come to your house and entertain your kids like I've done before.
Oh gosh! Don't. Hey, Andre, I got a secret. Don't tell Graham and Kevin, but you're my kid's favorite, actually. Okay.
I know. No, that's no secret. Enzo loves card tricks, man.
Oh man, he can watch that all day. Oh my goodness, guys. So where do we start? Did you guys see those meme stocks? Meme stocks.
Momentum.
I don't know. Yes,
momentum stocks.
Movement stocks. I call them movement stocks.
Momentum stocks were on the move today. GameStop was up 27%. I think AMC was up 20%. Obviously, the chef had a great day yesterday, up 10%. It was only up 2% today. We had, I'm trying to think some other ones. That Honest Company was up 8%. What do you think is going on here, Kevin? Because these are some pretty dang big moves.
Hey, well, first of all, I'm still lingering a little bit because I don't know. I thought Enzo and I had a thing with Lego, you know, Lego pretend guns. So I'm a little disappointed that the 24 frame per second master over here is flying these cards around. I'm trying to see how the trick's getting done well. And I'm like, why is he not on 60 frames so I can see it better? But yeah, look, I think people are transitioning from crypto and cash to stocks. I think the market's like, okay, look, we get it. There's Delta. We've been through this before. We've done the dress rehearsal. Okay, we get it. Well, the Fed's going to taper one of these days, or they won't. I think the market realizes we've heard supply chain shortages and a chip crisis and a container shipping crisis as well over and over again. Like, we're over it. We got it. The market priced in some fear last week. And this week, the market's just like, you know what? We got too much cash. We got too much crypto. Crypto's done well. Let's start moving into some buy the dip stocks. And I think the last, 2 days here, we've been seeing straight up buy the dipping.
It's crazy. The chip shortage is so bad that my Model Y order got pushed back from November to December now.
Wow.
It's crazy. Yeah. End of December. That's Ooh. Not fair.
Hey, Andre, yeah, while we're on the subject before we get back on the stocks of Tesla and a dirty little tactic. So this happened, Kevin. So Tesla Uh-oh. Delayed my Plaid. Now, I have it for $10,000 cheaper than what current customers have. So what I've been
told... Oh, they moved mine up.
Say what?
They moved mine up.
I know. So I can cancel my order, get the order a Plaid and get it like way sooner than mine. But from my understanding, they don't want to take that hit on margin. It's a $10,000 hit, right? And so they push back people like myself so they could sell full price Plaids first, bring down cost over the coming months. It's kind of dirty by Tesla.
Makes sense though.
Yeah, it's kind of dirty though.
I'm Wait, skeptical. How did you find out?
Yeah. How did you find out? As
I have been told. I have been told. Okay. That's all I'm going to say about that. I have been told that is a reason. Obviously, these are things that can't be confirmed, but I have been told that. And it honestly kind of makes sense. And I've heard other people complain about certain things like this in the past, but I don't know. It's just, I think Tesla put themselves in a weird situation because you know, usually Tesla wants to sell for the most money possible when they come out with a car. But now you got people like myself that have a $10,000 under what it currently is. So I don't know if that means Tesla loses money or they don't make any money on the car. But $10,000 is a lot, is not a small amount, right? Especially if you add it up across hundreds or thousands of cars. That could be the difference between an EPS hit or miss. And that could be the difference between everybody on CNBC saying Tesla just destroyed numbers or Tesla just had a small miss. And those are two very, very different things. And the stock price could react so differently.
I mean, that's in a way, that's kind of true. Because look, if you had a $140,000 car and, you know, the general profit on these is somewhere around, let's say, 23%, not including vehicular, you know, energy credits or whatever. That's $32,000. Of profit that's basically going of gross profit. And if you have an extra $10,000, which is basically pure profit, you know, additional $10,000, that's almost like 25% more profit per vehicle. So when you break it down like that, yeah, 10 grand of pure profit.
Yeah, but yeah, how big is that really going to be? Because it's only on the Plaid, unless you're doing this across all cars. And if you happen to buy the car before they raise the price, it's like a little bit on everything.
Well, maybe, but like the thing about the Plaid is the people who are buying the Plaid, they're basically, I mean, that's almost like, in my opinion, the profit for a company like Tesla, because, you know, you get a 23% margin or whatever on a, you know, Model Y or Andre's car, you know, like Andre's Model Y, for example, that's $11,000 of profit. That extra 10 grand is literally like all of the profit, like 10 grand more from Jeremy is literally like all of the profit on Andre's car.
Do you guys remember when they were giving away Roadsters to the people who were the top referees?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's how long are those people gonna have to wait for their Roadsters for the free road?
Part of me wonders if they're ever gonna get the car. I hate to say it, but by now I feel like they're gonna have to re-update the car so much, because how long have they been delaying this? 5 years now, 6 years?
Sure.
So by the time it's actually gonna be time to release the car, they're gonna be, well, we came out with the Roadster 2.0. It's even faster. It's even better. And then all the original people are like, wait a second, do I get the 2.0? And they're like, no, you don't get that.
Yeah, the terms have changed. That's true.
Yeah. Because you know what? They still did this. You know, I for a while, when they got rid of that the Roadster giveaway, they were doing this thing where for every person you referred to buy a Tesla, you had one entry to win either a Roadster, a Model Y. So they were giving away all these cars once a month. I have not seen one person win a car in 2 years.
No, not to mention, I was reading through Reddit and people were like, oh yeah, I was so excited to get my Model Y or my Model 3. They would come out with like the car and there's like a red bow on top of it. It would be like a whole event. And nowadays they're like, yeah, they don't even care. You just come in and you just pick it up. Like,
not to win the car.
It's just when they used to deliver cars before Tesla became so big, they used to make huge events out of every delivery. And now it's like, just go pick it up.
Yeah. I know when you go to pick up a car at Tesla nowadays, like sometimes they're like, do you need me to show you like how it works?
Right.
And you like, you know, I'm like, no, it's all right. And they're like, oh, thank goodness. You know, they don't say that, but in their head, they're like, let me just sign the next person. But we got to come back and talk about stocks. But first off, Kevin, I saw your video earlier today about the CNN situation. I know it's a completely different subject, but I just like itching to talk about that. That's crazy. I mean, for them to do, you know, that whole situation, that's nuts. I don't know if you want to tell people what happened there. That's disgusting.
Yeah, it's really sad because I just I don't know. I think I feel it. I feel like before politics, I had a whole lot more faith in, like, quite frankly, humanity, because it's just like every level of politician that we look into. Like, I've got a debate tomorrow in Sacramento against three other candidates. And every time I look into things, it's just like, oh, that seems shady. Or like, wow, it's where the political donations go. Surprise, surprise. That's what the politicians are doing. But this thing with CNN, I always thought, well, at least I'm sure the media is trying to be aggressive at trying to get the truth out there, which, you know, I look at now and I'm like, oh, I was pretty naive. But I thought that, you know, I thought, OK, well, these are our institutions and they don't want to be seen as giving wrong information, because if they give wrong information, they lose trust. Right. And so CNN publishes an article. And they know we exist. First of all, we're number one or number two in the polls to replace Gavin Newsom in August. We're kicking butt. The three people I'm debating tomorrow, I'm polling higher than all three of them combined.
Wow.
CNN pitches Newsom's idea of, oh, vote no on recall. And then they talk about Larry Elder, you know, vote for Larry Elder or whatever is his argument. And then they go, there are no Democrats competing against the governor from his own party. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, what have we been doing? Like, the Associated Press just did a piece on us. CNN did a piece on us. The Washington Post, the LA Times, the SAC B, San Francisco. Like, we're in all of the news. Fox puts us on TV. Fox showed up at our rally. Fox National showed up at our rally. And CNN wants to pretend we don't exist. It feels shady. It feels like it's almost like coordinated, like they're friends of Newsom and they're like, oh, we'll take care of you, Newsom. You know, it's just dark. Ugh.
Wow. Did they get back to you?
Nope, not yet. Nothing.
How long do you give them to get back?
End up having to file a lawsuit. They're just scumbags.
How long do you give them? 24 hours?
Probably, let this sit. Maybe decide exactly what we want to do by Thursday, Friday. Make sure, see that, you know, that would be plenty of time for them to have made corrections or whatever. But, you know, time's of the essence too, because the election's in like 3 weeks.
Got it. Kevin, you said notice with editors, they're so fast because they take that stuff so seriously. My experience with all editors is that usually during business hours, they'll get back to you within like an hour or two.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Kevin, did you see that story I sent you about the voting, the envelope where you could see if they voted for or not for? Is that any truth to that, or was that just a thing that got spread on TikTok?
Some counties have holes in the little envelopes for ballots. And these holes just happen to perfectly align with whether you filled in the circle on yes or no on recall. So you have to be really careful, like how you fold up the ballot to put it in. But I just don't put any shenanigans past what's happening in politics, because I think it's there's a lot more crookedness than meets the eye when you first think about it. And it's really sad, because it, you know, it gambles with people's lives. We wonder why things are so efficient. It's like, oh well, no surprise. I don't know, you see it, and it's just dirty. It's sad.
Jeez. All right.
Well, yeah, and just so everybody knows why that's such a big deal, this back to the CNN situation, it's such a big deal because essentially that can make people believe that if Newsom's out, then a Republican's in, and a lot of folks in California would be like, oh no, can't have that happen. So that's why it's such a big deal, right, Kevin?
Right. That, thank you for that, Jeremy. Yeah, they're creating this false dichotomy that it's either Newsom or it's Elder. Well, that's not true. It's either Newsom, and if it's either Newsom, yes or no, and if it's no Newsom, like get rid of Newsom, then we could, people could choose. They want a Democrat, a JFK style Democrat. Do they want Larry Elder? Do they want a different Republican? You know, there's plenty of choice.
Do you know roughly how many of the votes have already been put in?
The only score we had was last week. Friday, I want to say by last week Friday, maybe 8% of the ballots have been sent in. I think most people are going to get a lot more serious about this election in the last 2 weeks of the election.
I agree. When do you find out for sure? Is it going to be on the 14th, or is it going to be like?
Yeah, 14th? In fact, there's already like NBC and the Associated Press and other companies are like, Kevin, where's your viewing party going to be? And I'm like, we'll let you know when we know.
You know what, Kevin? You should come to Las Vegas and we can all do a viewing party together here.
On Millennial Money.
Oh, that
dude! That would be crazy, yes!
Wait a second. It is going to be a Tuesday, Kevin.
Oh, man. It's going to be Millennial Money night.
We got to do it.
For the night. You could fly in just for the night. If you win, we celebrate. When you win. How about that?
Yes.
When you win.
Dude, we live stream it on Millennial Money. Let us know in the comments if you guys would appreciate that. Smash a thumbs up if you guys
that'd want to so live cool. stream. That'd be so cool.
Oh, man. And it's interesting, Kevin, because it seems like, you know, your odds have just kind of gone up over time. So I'm just curious, would you rather have the election, let's say, 2 months from now versus it going on right now? Do you think that would have given you even more time, or do you think like it is what it is?
More time would have been great. They did this on purpose. It should have been November in a typical election time frame, but they had the right to move it up, and sure they did, because they were hoping that COVID wouldn't be a big issue and that fires wouldn't be a big issue. Both are big issues right now, and Newsom's kind of screwing up. So, you know, who knows? Hey. One of those things, though, that is what it is.
Dude, the fires are starting to make me mad, because the thing is, every day I have to wake up in here in Vegas, man, the smoke's coming up. It's clouds are clouded our whole city again today. The smoke coming from those California fires.
Wait, is there smoke today?
Yeah, it was smoky out there for sure, man.
Unless
the casinos let out all their smoke.
This just came out today and it blew my mind. So first of all, preface, about 2 months ago, NPR did this whole expose piece on how Gavin Newsom overstated fire prevention by 690%. So that's the old news. Today, leaked emails were discovered by the news that on the day that NPR article came out, the Newsom administration quickly tried to remove reference to their commitment from the websites of like Cal Fire and other departments, to pretend like they never made that promise that they were going to, you know, conduct certain acreage of wildfire clearing, or that they did. And so it's crazy, because it's like, wait a minute. So you lied about what you were going to do, and now you're trying to cover it up after you got exposed. It's like, this is classic crappy politics. It's like cancerous is what it feels like.
That's insane, dude. It's crazy that your nickname, the Meet Kevin thing, I thought that was really bad. Like, it seemed like it was the end of the campaign, and yet it was just a small bump in the road. Like, that was not a big deal.
Yeah, it ended up working out. I thought rebranding to Kevin Paffrath was going to be like so freaking hard, because everybody knows me as Meet Kevin. But so far it's been okay.
Yeah. That's cool.
So back to those meme stocks.
The momentum stocks.
The momentum stocks.
Okay, so hey, who's playing Robin Hood here? Personally, I'm not playing Robin Hood. I know that one's getting lumped up in there.
But
you are Graham. You're in the hood.
Listen, So I did not buy their IPO, but honestly, over the last, 2 weeks has it been? I've just been dollar cost averaging. That's it. I mean, it's not like a heavy position by any means, but, you know, every day.
Just a couple million dollars.
Just a couple million dollars. No, I think total 30 grand, I think I'm in so far, maybe 35 grand. And it's just, I'm probably going to get it to a size where it's equal to almost everything else that I own. And there's like 50 different stocks in there. That's it. And then to see what happens.
It's crazy. For most people, I guarantee you 30 grand is like their maximum position in like an average retiree's portfolio. But yeah, that is probably a small percent of your net worth. But still, now I haven't played Robinhood. I petition we change the ticker symbol to Rob instead of Hood. I'm just going to. I don't have it.
You've saved that joke all day.
I have. I practiced it in front of the mirror. But no, I skipped out on the IPO, and I wanted to buy it on the second day, but I was traveling. And then by the time the day finished, I was like, it got away. What did it go up? Like 20, 30%? I don't remember what it was.
It dropped a low third. It dropped like 33, and then it skyrocketed to 70. Out of nowhere. Yeah. And then it's been a slow and steady burn since then. And we'll see what happens over the next like 2-3 weeks. There is a lot of momentum around it. And I think the more that meme stocks go up, I think the better that is for really all stock trading platforms. It's not just Robinhood. I mean, I think that they're one of the easiest ones to invest in right now in terms of buying their company. But I think it's good for... Good, but it brings a lot of awareness and business to a lot of the platforms.
So besides Graham, do you guys follow any meme stocks? Are you buying anything or have you?
Oh, Jeremy, you want to go on this?
Well, how many is it? No, how much time do we have? No, but I mean, obviously you guys know what obviously I've been buying recently when it comes to the chef. So, but you know, when I look at it, it does make me say, man, you know, like, where's all that money come from in these squeezes? It can't be retail, right? Because retail's already bought into a lot of these names, right? Like, what made Chef go up 10% yesterday? It's not retail traders. Like, if retail was buying, they were buying on those, you know, when it dipped to 16 or whatever, right? You know, it's not retail that pushed up AMC 20% today. It's not retail traders that pushed up GameStop 27%. It seems like all of a sudden it's hedge fund money, maybe a coordinated move. That's not on the short side, and they're looking at this and they're like, hey, we can squeeze them here today. The hedge funds pile in, volume goes crazy, and next thing you know, all of a sudden the shorts are being forced to cover because the stocks, you know, goes up way more than shorts anticipate. Like, you know, a 10%, 15, 20% move, you know, those are huge. I think GameStop was up over 30% at some point today. That's going to force out a lot of shorts really quickly. And it seems like, honestly, it's big money moving around. It seems like retail just kind of like is along for the ride. And we're just kind of like surfing around if you're in any of the stocks.
Jeremy, are you looking at any graphs or charts that we could see that could tell exactly what the data is between who's buying? Like, is there such a thing that kind of exists where you can tell how much of it is retail volume, how much of it is institutional money?
I don't personally look at anything like that. Kevin might have something like that, but I don't look at anything like that. I don't know if Bloomberg Terminal would. I don't think they can really disclose it like that. I could be wrong, though. But, I mean, just usually it's a good thing to look at volume. If volume skyrockets on a random day, generally speaking, it's not retail. It can be, but generally speaking, it's not, especially if it's a stock that everybody knows about. Like, you know, you're looking at the stocks that pumped huge today, AMC, GameStop, all the, you know, everything in that space. Those are all stocks that are very, very known. And the fact that volume just goes crazy out of nowhere, it definitely feels like hedge fund money coming in. And then the shorts or, you know, the short hedge funds all of a sudden are like, crap, cover, 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 or being forced to cover because they stop losses start getting hit. And right. It just compounds. So what do you think, Kevin?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like we definitely have this risk on appetite right now. And one of the crazy things that happens is when risk goes on, people are looking for, okay, what's depressed? What has been sold down for a little bit? And then they just plow everything in. I don't know.
Let me ask you this real quick, Kevin. Who's people? Because I don't think John on Robinhood is doing that. I'm certainly not doing that. So who's people? I think you're speaking about hedge funds, really, because I don't think average Joes or even folks like myself are out there like also I'm like, oh, now we got to go all in today, you know.
I think you'd be surprised. I think a lot of people became traders during the pandemic, and you know they're trading with accounts ranging from $1,000 to $20,000, maybe $30,000, $40,000. And you know when you got $4,000 or $5,000, are you going to diversify into 50 different stocks? Probably not. It's like let's play the game. Let's trade. So I don't know. I think you might be surprised, and it could be a lot larger retail share. Now, don't get me wrong. Trade like the institutions, they trade too, and so I think they can exacerbate what's going on. But I wouldn't underestimate retail. I'd love to find a stat for you. I don't know how to find it, but I will.
So
try.
Do you think there's a chance then maybe just it just happens to go up alongside with the market, maybe 5-6%? People see that, start buying in, it starts rising higher. People are like, oh, this is it again. It's up 10%. Let's buy in, and then you slowly just start the cycle of piling in because it's going up. And now the fact that it hit, I think it was on the front page of CNN earlier today. Maybe at that now, you know what the downside is that it seems like every time it's on CNN, CNBC, it's too late. Almost yeah. Every single time. By the time they cover it, and that's the peak.
Yeah. Remember, have you guys heard the story about dark pools? Have you guys seen the story about dark pools, about how their lack of transparency and what they do, and they don't have to report trades? I think it was like several hours after they make it. I mean, it allows them to do some pretty crazy moves. I don't know if you guys are very familiar with it. It's very kind of like cloak and dagger element of the stock market. And I'm not like an expert on it, but it's really interesting.
I haven't seen it.
No? Yeah, dark pools are kind of fascinating. You should look into them. I don't know much about them. It's just it just allows hedge funds to execute their trades on better prices, and they don't actually pay any brokerage fees, and they're allowed to buy and sell positions without moving the underlying equity. So if they buy, let's say, whatever, a couple hundred thousand shares, normally if you were to do it on a public brokerage, the price of that stock would be affected, which is a good thing because it allows the public to see those stock prices move. And so it keeps us informed. But in a dark pool scenario, it allows them to buy in lump, kind of like wholesale, without affecting the price of the equity itself.
Usually, so, Andre, I think usually that situation is only if it's like a significant shareholder is trying to sell out or something. That you can kind of do a private deal like that. For instance, Steve Wynn had a step down from Wynn, obviously he owned like 10 or 12% of the company or something like that. They're not going to do that on the public market, obviously, because that would just be ridiculous to sell 10 or 12% of the company in one day or something like that, or in 1 hour. So that might be what you're referring to there, I'm thinking. And sometimes it makes sense, but for the most part, unless it's some crazy lump sum like that, usually it has to go through the public markets. But
this happens with the meme stocks is kind of what I'm getting at. Like this happens, and they manipulate the prices behind closed doors without really us knowing. So there is some really special wizardry going on behind the scenes that I think a lot of people are not aware of. So I'd be interested to learn more about it. I don't know much about it.
Definitely things could go on behind closed doors that you don't even need to get into any dark pool situation. Like, for instance, it wouldn't have been rocket science for a few big hedge fund managers, not even huge hedge fund managers, just a few big actively traded funds to have had a meeting yesterday or the day before and been like, hey, you know, Tuesday. Let's move these babies and, you know, just buy up everything in sight. They push the price up so fast. There's not enough selling pressure out there. And there's just so much buying pressure. And next thing you know, you get a massive short squeeze. It amplifies it. And then they back it with more buying on top of that. Then also you can get more retail in saying, oh, man, this is the move.
But that's the difference is when you do that on a public exchange, those price changes are immediate. Whereas in a dark pool, they're not reflected until several hours after they happen. And that's when the public gets hurt because we don't have that info the moment that it happens.
Yeah. Kevin, what do you have?
I don't know. I know there's always a hunt, especially in momentum stocks, to look for the boogeyman and a reason to invest. I think there are a lot of arcane things that happen in finance and in the institutional world, but I don't know how much of that has to do with coordinated attacks by multiple different funds, because I feel like they would all try to take advantage of each other if they could. You know what I mean? Like, to balance out those bets. So I don't know. I mean, that's it. To me, I try not to let that affect my investing. Let me put it that way.
Sure.
Graham, in LA real estate, is there anything that ever goes on? You know, we're talking about this dark pool situation. Is there ever a situation where a house can kind of not actually be publicly listed, but if you're in the know, you kind of get a heads up on it? Like, hey, this isn't publicly listed yet, but we're letting a certain group of folks goes on?
Kevin's smiling because we've gotten into some debauchery where Kevin was debating people who would argue. They're called pocket listings. Okay. And I don't want to say all the time, but there are listings where the seller just doesn't want the hassle of listing the home publicly on the MLS. They don't want to field a whole bunch of phone calls. They don't want a whole bunch of strangers running through the house. So instead, either the realtor calls up and say, hey, I got a client who wants to buy your house. Do you want to sell it? Yes, no. Or they call the realtor and they say, hey, if you have a buyer who's interested in paying this, let us know. We don't want to list it. We don't want anybody to know about it. But if you have somebody, and of course, the realtor will, you know, make a few phone calls, call around every now and then, we'll bring a buyer. So it happens. It's usually something that's beneficial to the seller. And the buyer also likes the fact that they're getting something that's off market. It's kind of it's got an allure to it. But usually it's better for the seller to list the property in the MLS, gain maximum exposure.
No.
Funny enough, The Weeknd just bought a $70 million home in Los Angeles that was off market.
Wow.
It was an off market deal. And I was reading up on it. Really great. These two realtors, Brandon and Rainey, they're one of the best, one of the top, besides the Oppenheim Group, of course. But Brandon and Rainey are really one of the top realtors, and they have been for quite some time in LA. And apparently, they just called up the seller and they say, hey, we're working with a buyer right now. Your house is perfect. Would you consider selling it? And they thought, well, if we get this price, fine. Brought them the price, $70 million.
Wow.
And it's a gorgeous house. It's really nice.
That's incredible. And so now, wouldn't these pocket listings, are they generally above a certain price point?
No.
Okay.
They could be usually, I mean, if we're putting them into categories, generally above like 30, 40 million, you're more likely to get pocket listings just because the sellers are really private people. They don't want pictures of their house online. And plus, you got to think the market of the type of buyers willing to spend $70 million on. I mean, it's probably a few thousand people realistically, or maybe a few hundred at any given time looking to buy a house. You don't want to advertise that on Zillow. So, but you know what? It does exist in lower price points, but usually those are from agents who are like, hey, I just got a client. There's nothing available. You want to sell your house? They'll pay the X amount. Perfect.
No,
simple.
When it comes to NFTs, I've seen people manipulate them and sell them to their friends and be like, hey, I made this artwork. Could you buy it for me for like $100,000 and then resell it, right? And so it creates this artificial market price that perhaps is not deserved. And there's a lot of price manipulation. So has there ever been any incidences in real estate that maybe the same thing kind of has happened?
Here's one thing I want to mention on NFTs. It would be silly. I mean, you really have to be kind of a nutty to purchase an NFT beyond a certain point, because you got to think of the fees associated with that. I mean, what are some of these companies taking, like 20 to 50% on NFTs, right? On a lot of there's some that where you create them yourself and they take like 40-50%.
Yeah,
I remember.
But
if
you're selling $100,000 NFT that was worthless a couple minutes ago, well, what's 10%? You know, it's like whatever, you know.
10 grand. Okay. Well, anyway, you know, you get these. The only time I've seen some shady business in real estate was it's only happened once, but there was a house that the seller was just a little, didn't exactly know, like he never lived in this house. and bought it for a price that, in my opinion, was like 35% above what the place was actually worth at the time, cash. And it made me think, well, is there something suspicious going on? I mean, you're paying 35% over asking cash on a place that you never lived in. Maybe there's something going on, but that's the shadiest that I've seen.
Kevin, like, it's so easy. Sorry, it's just like list a house and then let a wealthy family member just buy it from you. And they'd be like, well, it previously sold for whatever. And then let me put it on the open market. Just that's what people do on NFTs all the time. I don't know. There's got to be a lot of shady stuff that goes on everywhere. Real estate.
That's a hassle. And then you have to deal with property taxes being reassessed.
That's right. Oh, right. That's true.
Yeah.
Kevin, Graham said it's something about debate around this populist thing. Did you hate him? Did you like him? Well, what's going on here? I got to know about this.
Love them as a buyer. When things happen off market in real estate, personally, I think that the seller usually ends up getting ripped off because they're not exposing themselves to full potential market value of what they could get if there was a competition for that property. In stocks, I don't know if the desire is the same, because you've got price discovery is very clear in the stock market. When you have, so let's say you have a dark pool, and let's say Andre, you're dark pool one or whatever, you guys are both in a pool. Let's say Andre, you're, I don't know, broker A, and Jeremy, you're broker B. And Andre's like, hey man, I got to sell 500,000 shares of AMC. And Jeremy's like, okay, hey, we can get that. It's going to take us a couple hours or whatever to get all those access to all those shares or whatever. And hey, we'll get those bought from you or something like that. To me, the negotiation between both of you guys, in my opinion, won't necessarily be so heavily involved in the price, because the price is available on the open market. We look at the open market and go, oh, okay, it's $45 today or whatever it is. All right, well, hey, I mean, we could sell them to you for $45.25, you know, maybe 25 cents more or whatever, right? Or a fraction more, pennies more, who knows? The price discovery isn't so much of the issue. So even with a dark pool of these trades happening, it's not like Jeremy wants to, Jeremy, you know, you want to buy shares for $70 of AMC, because you could do that on the open market. And it's not like Andre's going to sell shares of AMC for $20, because he could just dump them on the open market for over time and get a good price. So I think with stocks, I don't see the obsession personally as much with dark pools. Maybe I'm missing something. I just don't see the obsession, because if something's happening off market, usually the biggest issue is price discovery. But the market price changes every tick, you know, every second. Like, it's very obvious what the price is. It's just maybe more of a stability thing, because like I said, you know, if Andre is going to dump 500,000 shares of AMC, the stock would just plummet 10%. He wouldn't be able to, the order book's not large enough, right? With real estate, the reason off-market deals are a problem is because you don't actually know what a property is worth until it hits the market, because the market can then evaluate the pricing of that property.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
That's a great, you're making a great point there, Kevin. Yeah, because I mean, imagine, let's say I own hypothetically 4% of Tattooed Chef, and I'm like, I need to sell out of that today. I got to put that money somewhere else. Dude, if I try to sell 4% of the company all at one time, I mean, that stock price would crash, you know, in a massive, massive way. It'd be so much selling pressure. So it makes much more sense to do something, either off market or figure out some sort of deal. Because otherwise, I mean, the shareholder is going to get absolutely decimated. Some people might love that. They might love the stock crashing and get to buy it for $6 or whatever. But outside of that scenario, it would, you know, it would get pretty ugly pretty fast. So, but speaking about manipulation, I finally got a chance a few days ago to watch CoffeeZilla's 35-minute video on Tether.
Great video.
Yeah, phenomenal video. And I was just curious, Andre, if you ever saw that video and kind of what your opinion was on that whole situation with Tether, or let's just call it, we don't even have to just talk about Tether. We could even talk about, you know, let's call it stable coins in general. And do they have an impact on Bitcoin's price and things like that?
Yeah, we've known about, I haven't seen that specific video from him, but we've known about Tether for a long time. 2017 was the reason Bitcoin pumped because of Tether. So Tether just printed a ton of these. And then for anybody who doesn't know, Tether is just a stable coin that's supposed to represent $1 for every dollar that we create. You know, we create a stable coin. So for every dollar deposited. So yeah, Bitcoin pumped in 2017 because they printed an insane amount. And they never really gave us the numbers publicly, how much they had on the balance sheet. Because the idea is they have, you know, a dollar for every dollar they issue as a stable coin. But they didn't want to be audited. And, you know, Bitcoin pumped. Now, I don't know the state of Tether today and how much it's responsible for the price movement. You can actually check that stuff on chain. But every time Bitcoin has pumped to like an insane amount and it's gone like parabolic, there's an almost one-to-one correlation between Bitcoin's price going up and Tether's being printed. So, I mean, that's a really interesting kind of observation. But, you know, how much of Bitcoin's price today is responsible because of Tether, I have no idea. It could very well be 90%. It could be 10% correlation. I have no idea off the top of my head. But I don't know if that video talked about that.
Well, that video got into a lot. It was 35-minute beast. I mean, they got into so many different things. I mean, even about the Tether founders and whatnot, and a little bit of the correlation between, let's say, stable coins and Bitcoin's price. And if you look at, you know, Tether, basically from April, you know, throughout the end of last year, I mean, even into the beginning of this year, it was just, the amount of Tether that was created was astronomical. And also Bitcoin went from 3,000 to, you know, 60,000 in that same amount of time. And so it's like, is any of that because of Tether? Is a lot of that because of Tether? Is almost all that because of Tether? How much of a factor does that play in it?
Another very interesting thing about Tether is that you would think that for a private company that's printing, essentially, that's doing what a central bank's job would be, you would think that at this point in time that like somebody would have stopped them, right? Like the Fed or somebody, the SEC, or would have stepped in and said like, hey, like, what are you guys doing? And yet no one's come to step in. And that's the only sketchy part of that story is I don't know if we're exaggerating what's going on with Tether or if there's something that's that really seriously wrong that's going on. That's like,
well, the issue is the United States doesn't really have jurisdiction over them. And so it makes it into a really, really tough situation here where the United States is kind of in this situation where it's like, do they have the power to do anything? Can they do anything? And so that's what makes it tough. But
they tried to take down Ripple like that, where it's what was it? The SEC said that they're basically issuing shares of a company because each token is representing a piece of their company. And so in that sense, they were able to go after Ripple. But I can see how with Tether, technically, you can't really go after them. There's no precedent that's set. There's no agency that can go after them. Gosh.
And the craziest thing is they're supposed to be one of the biggest players in the entire world when it comes to, if I recall, the short-term bond market or just the bond market in general, if I recall. And yet all the big bond traders are like, we never heard of them before. Like, you know, and they know everybody that's the biggest players. And so that's where it kind of starts leading into. It's like, are they just, you know, saying that this stuff is backed and it's not really backed? And, oh, yeah, we're one of the biggest players in commercial debt or commercial paper or whatever. And really they're non-existent because all the big traders are like, we've never even heard of them. Like, what? And they're one of the biggest in the world. Like, how is that even possible? It doesn't make sense.
So, right.
Graham, Kevin, what's your guys' two cents on this subject?
I don't know. I think, listen, they're a shady company. You can't even call them a company. I don't know. There's somebody behind it. The whole business practice to me sketches me out 100%. I think everyone in crypto has kind of embraced the fact that it's probably not backed by anything. At some point, it's going to come to a standstill. How much of that is already priced in? I think at this point, investors are already acknowledging what it is and either don't care or it's just, it is what it is. And they'll, you know, Bitcoin is going to be around for quite some time. It's just might be a little speed bump.
Yeah, it's kind of like the boogeyman we've all accepted. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, I stable coins, they've made me nervous. I love that we just had this fall recently to 29K. I really wish we fell down to like 19K so we could put some more stress on stress testing the whole system. But I love it when it plummets. So that way we test the market and I actually feel more confident about the crypto space. So yeah, I've been skeptical about stable coins in December. Of this year, December or first week of January, I made a video about like how cryptocurrency would collapse if it were to happen, and we're all about the failure of stable coins. So it's something that's something worth paying attention to. The more we get big dips and then recoveries, though, the more comfortable I am knowing that okay, maybe this is just a nasty beast, but hopefully it just becomes more and more irrelevant over time.
Yeah. I love what you said. This was going on when we were talking about BlockFi and how stable coins could theoretically collapse in value. And I think you told me something along the lines of that there was nothing in history of mankind that we've ever created that was a stable coin where it was a derivative of something else that ever survived. I don't know if you could elaborate on that. Like, do you remember that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I don't think there's ever been because a stablecoin is almost like fiat, right? It's the belief that this represents value that you could redeem for something else. And in the history of basically fiat or stablecoins in this definition, currencies don't survive. And so over, obviously we have more modern institutions now. Like I think the US dollar is something that has a lot more strength to be able to survive. But I mean, there are also paths charted for the US dollar to disappear one day. You know, if we never end up dealing with the debt we have and people start losing faith in US dollar assets, backed assets or whatever versus crypto, then what if the dollar does evaporate one day, right? But yeah, it is kind of crazy to think that no currency has ever survived.
Kevin, I just sent a screenshot. You might want to put that up there. It's pretty intriguing. Yeah. It shows, the stable coins, how much has been created over the past 1 year. You could pretty much almost identically follow Bitcoin, across that time. And it looks like a very, very similar chart. It's intriguing. Man, I don't know. I think something to be worried about, but I think it would be something that would be more of a short-term worry. But I kind of always worry about like the crash that actually hurts most people. But let's see. So look at that.
So here's Tether.
Yeah.
And then this is over time. So it starts in September 20 though. So you've got this move up in Tether printing. And this has actually been where Bitcoin prices have shot up. But interestingly, Bitcoin prices really failed in this range right here. So I don't know. You know, that's a lot of Tether going value going up here.
And remember, Bitcoin, stable coins aren't inherently bad by themselves. It's just that they're only bad if what we're printing isn't backed by anything, right?
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that Tether is the only example of that and that there's not more sketchy things going on. But that's why I think we do need regulation. That's why whenever I say that in my videos, people are like, oh, you're not a true crypto supporter because you want regulation. And I'm just like, no, I think it'll make the market safer and better. And for exactly these reasons.
Yeah, I wish the other one I would have pulled up was Tether. If you look at the amount of Tether created in 2018, 2019, up until about April of 2020, very little. And Bitcoin seemed to not really go much of anywhere during that time. So once again, there might be nothing there. It's just, it is a little scary. And then when you like, is this actually backed by anything? And things like that. And I think the reason it's a scarier subject now than it's in the past is in the past, crypto, it was kind of like this thing. And it's like, okay, it's just some kids playing around over there. If they get hurt, they get hurt. But crypto has gotten so big now and it has so all four of us have some sort of ties to crypto, right? We either own crypto straight up or we own crypto brokerages or something, right? So all four of us do. That couldn't have been said 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 8 years ago, right? And imagine how many folks in general now are in the crypto space. And so I think, and does the government, you know, if this baby falls, is the government going to be there to save the day? I just don't think so.
No. Yeah. No way.
Absolutely no. Yeah.
But and it's the only market where the government's not going to be there to save the day. The government will do whatever it takes to keep housing up. Government will do whatever it takes to stabilize the financial markets and try to get the stock market back up, right? Crypto, are they? Yeah. Once again, I don't think any of us believe that they would be there to save the day. And so that's where I kind of get into this thing. And I'm like, could that be what actually takes us down? Because there's always this feeling like something's going to take us down. Is that it? Or is it not?
Bright, bad idea. What if we create a central bank, Fed-like, Federal Reserve, millennial money bank before regulations, and we become the supporters? So in case anything goes wrong, we just be like, gotta flood the system with more stable coins.
Quick. We can do a save the coins token.
Save the coins token. That's awesome. I love that. Hey, why not? Because we have a limited amount of money. That's why.
How about a stable coin for stable coins?
That's right.
We'll give you back our stable coin.
That's one of those bad ideas. You're like, that would never work. But sure. Wait a minute. Yeah. So Jeremy, to your point, or rather against your point, the only thing, and this is something like I don't know how to resolve or like how to come to a conclusion with this, but now that the crypto market is bigger than it was in 2017, at what point do we cross that threshold? And it's like, well, the crypto market is big enough that even if Tether were to fail, that it wouldn't make much of a difference. I don't know what that amount is. Have we hit it yet? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a big question. And the thing is like, man, I mean, you watch what can happen in the stock market and how that can fall, right? I mean, we saw it obviously when Roni Rona took off 35% in 22 trading days. And I think the real thing will be if we get a massive crash ever, and it's actually a sustained one, because I feel like this last, you know, Bitcoin pullback, it didn't really feel like it should have, right? Because we kind of just bounced back up, right? And so
there needs to be a serious flash crash, kind of like what Kevin was saying. We need to go from 50K to 20K in like a day or two. Then we'll have a great idea of how stable the system is. But that's so point. Far, we've just I been like just that. Like, let's go down slowly. I mean, that doesn't stress test the system, right? So, yeah. Let's crash the market. No, just kidding. Let's not do that.
And the question is, if we were to get this sort of, let's say, real big crash in crypto, and it was like, let's say something that lasted a year or two, what would be the domino that fell first? Would it have to be the global economy falls? Would it have to be the credit markets dry up? Would it have to be something like a Tether goes down? Like could we foresee anything there? Because I'm just trying to see like where's the next big, you know, like it always feels like there's going to be something that gets us, right? And it's just a matter of time, and it's just like a ticking time bomb, and we don't know where it's going to come from. You know, 2000, it was stock market. 2008, it was real estate. The Roni Rona situation, that was very short-lived. That was everything pretty much got hit, but it was very, very short-term. Then we bounced back. And so is it going to be crypto? Is that the next shoe to fall that's going to get everybody? And if so, yeah. Where did it come from?
It's going to be Dogecoin.
Dogecoin.
I'm just kidding. No, that's a great question. I don't know. People have been talking about these bubbles for so long tuition, the debt bubble with, you know, student loans to – gosh, what other bubbles are there? Real estate bubbles, stock market bubbles. There's like bubbles everywhere. I don't know. What other bubbles am I missing?
The everything bubble.
The everything bubble. Yeah. You know,
I like Kathy Wood's thought on a bubble. She said, it's really interesting, the market's not in a bubble because people are talking about it being in a bubble. And the fact that people are acknowledging that it's a bubble means it's probably not a bubble. Bubbles are usually when nobody's talking that it's a bubble.
Yeah, that's she great says.
That was a reference to the stock market, though. That I will say, that was a reference to the stock market specifically, right. Not really to like real estate or to crypto or something like that. I feel like you can't I feel like no one really tries to call crypto a bubble now because one, they look stupid every time crypto goes up huge, right? And two, it's like if you say crypto is a bubble now, like why didn't you say it a year ago? Because you could have said the same thing. It, like, you know, it's just, I don't know, man. But I feel like, what do you think, Kevin? Come on, explain this to me. Macroeconomics.
Look, people have too much money, man. Just look at reverse repos. You know, it's everybody's got money. It's crazy, especially people who have been part of the stock market for the last year. Look, since February, things have been crap. There's been plenty of reasons to have, unless of course you were an index funds Graham. but there's been a lot of uncertainty and a lot of like the waves. The way I almost think about it is like the fish tank. Graham's fish tank is like on a truck and it's just going up a hill with his index fund. But because it's on a semi truck, the water inside the fish tank is like, oh my gosh. But it just keeps going up. Meanwhile, everyone's panicking inside the fish tank. But there's so much money, man. I don't know. I just don't see a big collapse anytime soon.
Wow. So there's too much money. So man, that's interesting. So there's too much money, so just nothing bad can really happen then.
You know what's interesting? But for the last year, if you look at the entire S&P 500, and not to say this is going to continue, but for the last year, it's very interesting. We hit a new high. We immediately dropped 3-5% over the following week. People start buying in. It goes back up. There's a new high a few weeks later, drops 3-5%. People come by. This has been going on for the past year. This is not just something last few months. This is the last year we've done this. Now, eventually, we'll hit that 5%. It'll keep dropping. But for now, it seems to be following this pattern that, at this rate, the S&P could be at, 47 in a few months from now. I mean, who knows? But listen, at this point, it's like when things drop, I'm sitting like with Kevin. I'm just buying. I just keep buying. So, there is a lot of money sitting on the sidelines.
And to Kevin's point, Fidelity just did a study where they said that there are now more 401k and IRA millionaires, 74.5% year over year.
Wow.
74.5% more accounts have hit the seven-figure mark in just the last year. That's crazy. So we have a lot of money.
Yeah, let's talk about who's really got the money though. You know, I hear this, everybody's got too much money. Is it literally everybody? Is it the middle class? I think that's my question. Is it the middle class even has too much money, or is it only, let's say, the top 10% that has too much money?
It's the older people, right? It's the older generation that have been investing for 30, 40 years. That seems to be the one, I would imagine. Hello. What do you guys think?
What do you think, Kevin?
Everyone.
Right. It's literally everyone. It's the fact that people who have never been invested in stocks in 2020 and even into 2021 got into stocks. People who were in 2020 made lots of money. The people who weren't in, didn't get in 2020, got in 2021. Like, oh my gosh, everybody's making money. So we've gone from this society of oh no, like investing, that's you need a manager or whatever for that, and I'll invest one day in the future too. No, invest now and let it sit there. That's why there's just so much more money. It's this new, like Ray Dalio says, it's a new paradigm. Of course, his vision is still that at some point we're in the seventh or eighth inning and the big crash is coming, which whatever, right? But maybe, but for right now, it's money. People got too much of it.
Too much. Yeah. Jeremy, it just seems like there's so much information out there, even with our YouTube channels. I mean, like, look how many videos we put out every week and every month. And we're kind of more or less saying, we're following the same paths and the same steps that we've done for the last decade. And I feel like because of this open information, it's just like Kevin said, people are investing more. We're not like, we know the basic tenets of investing, just buy and hold index funds, just keep accumulating the shares. Don't pay attention to what the market's doing. And that's more true than ever before. So yeah, like what Kevin said about Ray Dalio's seventh inning thing, I don't even know if that's ever going to happen. I just feel like we're smarter now as a result of the technology, as a result of YouTube and all the videos that we've done. And I don't know, we probably play like 1% of the role, but I'm just, if that, but still.
Yeah, no, that's an intriguing thing. And then it's like, you know, if a shoe does ever drop, why not just print a bunch of money? Fed, come on, J-Pal. I mean, you know, that's another thing we kind of got to consider there. And so, you know, when these people make these bets, let's say a bearish bet on the market's going to crash, you know, ARK fund's going to crash, whatever, right? I mean, a lot of times they're predicting that there's kind of this like dry up of money and everybody starts selling and you know, pulling back, and it could happen, but it's hard to see if the Fed really just steps back in and just like, oh, here's the money sloshing out there. So I don't know.
And they'll just print more if Delta gets bad, and then we'll have even more money.
You know what? But could that be a potential reason why the stock market is doing better? Because Delta is getting a bit worse, people are a little bit less worried about the money printer stopping.
Yes.
So that's kind of what I'm thinking, yeah, too. I mean, from the stock market's perspective, the longer this continues, the higher it's going to go. But then you also risk the higher it goes, the bigger the drop. Could be, if it does, maybe not. But
the longer the taper stays, the longer the music's on at the club, and the longer people are happy, or the longer the taper doesn't happen, right? You know, if Delta means it delays the taper and we keep printing money, great, the party keeps going. And, you know, I don't think people are, you know, in a hurry to really get out of the market anytime soon. They just don't want to miss the opportunity of it going up, especially if inflation inflects downwards.
You know when the market's going to crash? It's going to crash when everybody reasons exactly like that. When everybody's going to be like, the party's never going to end. The Fed's going to save us. And when everybody says that, that's when it's going to go sideways. That's going to go south.
A lot of people are already thinking that, though, that the Fed is not going to let the market crash.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so far, they have not.
Maybe we'll never see it crash.
The Fed will never – I don't think the Fed will ever come out. You know, unless we have this real collapse in the market like we did in March of 2020, where we were worried about banks going under and credit not flowing. I don't think the Fed is going to ever come out and just bluntly say, hey, like, we need to save the stock market. They don't really care. I think we saw that in like February and March when the Fed's just like, it doesn't matter, you know, asset values are high or whatever. The way they come out is they go, we want to make sure that blacks and Hispanics or women or other people who are disproportionately represented in service jobs have an opportunity to participate in the economic recovery. That's sort of their go-to. And so as long as the black and Hispanic unemployment rate remains higher, substantially higher than the white unemployment rate, and the longer the women unemployment rate remains higher, I think the longer the cheap money will keep flowing. So those are the numbers I would look at if you're worried about the Fed.
That's interesting. That's a cool
idea. Wow. Yeah, and then it leads into a subject. You say, well, if the Fed helped, or the money sloshing has helped the economy and wages have finally really started roaring up. Like, I don't know what the data shows from the government, but I know, Kevin, recently you posted something somewhere about a job at Panda Express paying something. And I had lunch with a friend today, and he said that one of his kids just got a job fresh out of high school, $23 an hour. I'm like, what? I know. I'm like, I had my first job was $7.50 an hour, and I'm like, you know, I felt lucky. Dude, I felt lucky to get that job for $7.50 an hour. $23 an hour, like out of high school, no college. I'm like, dude, that's insane. And I'm good for him and good for them.
Now, here's the thing. Here's a serious question, though. Are they hiring that person full time, or are they giving them 28 hours a week? Because I think make a difference if you're paying that price for part-time work versus full-time 40 hours a week.
I don't know, but regardless, man, I wish those jobs were there when I got out of high school, man. I would have made a lot more money and invested a lot faster, making $23 an hour. And I mean, you see it in Vegas, a lot of these jobs, very entry-level jobs at like, you know, working as like a cook at a fast food place, it's like $15, $16, $17 an hour, you know? I mean, those jobs were just so dang hard. Retail's even gone up substantially. Like, you know, I think Target, if you want an entry-level Target job, I think you're over $15 an hour in Vegas, if I recall. I think I've seen the signs and it's like pays 15 something an hour, 15.50 or whatever. I'm like, geez. But then you get into the subject, if that's good, then do we ever do a universal basic income?
That's going to come back. I guarantee you that's going to be a subject that's going to come back and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah, it's a matter of time. Maybe right now is not the moment when it's appropriate because people feel like, well, there's a lot of jobs out there and in those sorts of things. But if all of a sudden we'd get going that other way, it might be like, well, look, we printed all that money. We put all that money in the economy and look what it did to the economy in 2021 or out of that or into 2022. And now we need to do something similar. Why not do universal basic income?
I would not be surprised. They've been testing it out in small groups so far. And I think more testing needs to be done. But it does seem as though there are some good cases for it that people can focus on finding the right job that's good for them instead of taking the first job that's available at the lowest pay just because they need to get a job. So I think there are cases both for and against it. But it'll be easy to see how this really takes shape here in the U.S.
There's a lot of people that are more open to the idea. And I think what happened in 2020 made a lot of folks. I remember I had a friend who's a very, very staunch Republican, you know, it's like super, super Republican, right? And I remember asking him, I said, you know, when they were going to give out the money to the small businesses, I was like, hey, don't you think that's like a little socialistic, you know, because he's like so against socialism or whatever. And he was kind of like, no, it's okay, you know. And so I think that's kind of like that slow kind of melting in where certain folks on that side start feeling like, ah, it's not the worst thing. I could understand it. And then the other side's all for it. You only need a little over half the folks to believe in it, right? So yeah. I don't know.
People say some funny stuff, though. I've heard some like, it's like, yeah, I was on food stamps before, but the government didn't help me.
So I looked this up, Graham, and it looks like leisure and hospitality, you might be right, leisure and hospitality out of all of the weekly hours of like mining or construction or manufacturing or wholesale trade, utilities, whatever, leisure and hospitality, and it's always been this case, have the lowest average weekly hours and overtime worked. The lowest reading here, it's 26.6 hours is the average weekly earned. And this has been the case in 2020. This has been the case in months prior. Out of all of the work sectors, leisure and hospitality has the lowest hours.
Makes sense. And keep in mind, too, I think a good reason for that is because of just how many people, if someone cancels last minute or can't make it, you need so many backups. And I think the turnover for a lot of that's pretty high. So you have to keep getting people in. But also, you don't want to give them 40 hours because then what is it? Full time? And then they get all the other benefits. And that's too much money. So you got to give them just enough.
A lot of times the benefits both sides, you know, because you think about it, like a lot of times, like the worker, like when I used to work at Walgreens, I wasn't necessarily looking for 40 hours a week, right? Because I was like running track, going to college and stuff like that. So, but I remember at Walgreens, I think if you went over 30 hours consistently, then you were like full time and you got certain benefits and whatnot. So, yeah, obviously, the incentive back then at least was to keep you under 30, unless you were truly like a somebody that was going all the way. So, but anyways, guys, any crypto stocks we're buying out there? I've obviously been, you know,
at you last know why, I will say not crypto, but gosh, I've been getting really tempted to buy a CryptoPunk.
What?
An NFT. NFT. All right.
Yeah.
That's fine.
I'm just starting. I'm doing research on it, and probably a ways away from doing something like that. But I don't know. I've wanted to buy a. It sounds crazy, but a Keith Haring, like an original Keith Haring, and it's been a huge fan. But I don't know. I started to look at like the values of some of these things, and it's CryptoPunks.
Wait, Graham, tell people who don't know what that is. What is that?
So CryptoPunks are an NFT, and they're like the most basic. It's kind of silly looking. It's like pixels. It's these silly little things. There's 10,000 of them, but they're all unique. They're all a little bit different. And right now, I think the cheapest CryptoPunk is like $200,000+. It's wild. Now, I think just a year ago, these things were like, what, 10, 20, 30, 50 grand, like somewhere around there. they're going up. I could see these things in the future being double or triple what they are. I know it sounds nuts. Give 10 years, 20 years. I could see.
Jeremy's like, how do you value this stuff? I don't understand.
This is
a part of the episode where I just start going off. I'm not even going to say anything. But Kevin, when you said people have way too much money, you meant it. And you were right.
Yeah. Go on.
I was mostly just talking about Graham. He's trying to, you know, buy new cars, buy a bigger fish tank, buy another house in Vegas. I don't know. It's like he's bored. He's bored. That's what it is. He's bored of the index fund.
I don't know. But when you put a Keith Haring and a CryptoPunk side by side and you think what is going to have a higher resale value 20 years from now, I would
not tattoo chef stock.
Or tattoo chef stock. You probably have to give it to the CryptoPunk, though. You know, and we'll see. Here's the thing. It's like, I feel like if there's going to be a huge crash, that's going to be hit the hardest. I mean, this could easily fall 80%, 85%. So,
yeah, that's very adventurous of you. I don't really mess with NFTs too much. I have one from Steve Aoki, and I'm waiting for the people who create these NFTs to give them some use cases. Like, if I'm Steve Aoki, I want to say, hey, if you have my NFT, you can come to my show. You can come to the club and watch my for a lifetime's worth. That's cool. That makes sense to me. That's a valuable, tangible thing. But so far, I haven't seen it on that level yet. And I don't know. That's what I'm waiting
Visa.
For.
Visa just bought earlier today. It's just a pure coincidence. Bought a CryptoPunk.
Really?
And it's Visa, and they made it a Twitter profile picture.
You know, they're just doing it for publicity.
Of course. But I'm just saying, of all the things they could have done for publicity, they chose a CryptoPunk. And again, I think it's very hypey right now. So like, this is not something I would be doing anytime soon. But
I saw one for half a million, I think, right? It was I saw one sell for like half a million, I think, at some point.
You know what? Even Christie's. Even Christie's was, I think either they sold CryptoPunks or they have them featured. But it's interesting. Even Christie's is taking them seriously. The most expensive one sold for $7.5 million.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's insane. Oh, my gosh. Nah. Yeah. Not for me for now. I'm not that adventurous yet. I'm not that bored with my index funds yet. I hope to get to that point. No, but definitely we'll experiment with it. Jeremy, we're trying to get you to buy crypto. You're like, NFTs?
Yeah. But I'm looking at this here. It looks like Visa is trying to be the payment processor in the future of people buying NFTs. So it's brilliant. It's an investment. Visa was built on the vision of electronic enablement of moving money, blah, 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 blah. Visa strives to enable connections to new crypto and blockchain networks, offering greater choice, enabling access, blah, blah, blah. Basically, they want to be your payment processor. So, of course, they want to get into the NFT world because basically they're bestowing legitimacy onto the NFT world and then saying, by the way, let us be the payment processor when you go buy NFTs. They're going to make their money back like that.
Yeah, they probably have aspirations to be like the next Lightning Network, essentially.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yep.
Just something to think about. Putting it out there, I want to get something else. But just throwing.
He's got
it
too
out.
Much money, everyone. He's bored.
Graham, are you bored? Be honest with us.
He's not denying it.
Listen, I will tell you, I got something else. But
oh gosh,
it's cheap. It's not that expensive. But you know the I don't want to give away the whole thing.
Not that much.
But you know the Goosebumps books covers, the art.
I knew you were gonna say Goosebumps.
I got a I bought a authentic sketch signed by the illustrator.
Oh, that's awesome!
So I thought this is cool.
That's super cool.
He's looking for write offs at this point.
At that time of the year. Yeah. Anyway, there's just alternative things that I think are fun that, you know, they're not. I don't think they're going to go down in value. That's all.
I'm trying my best not to say anything, you know. If it was Kevin or Andre, I would easily attack and go on the attack right now. But since it's Graham, I'm just going to let it slide.
All right.
We'll see. Keep my mouth shut.
We'll see. Just give it 10 years. Just give it 10 years. We'll come back.
Let's just wrap up this episode, because the longer we go, the more it's going to be hard for me. Can we just wrap it up, guys?
All right. So with that said, you guys, make sure to check out the Millennial Money Clips channel down below in the description. Just go and subscribe to that. Totally free to do. Right down below in the description, super easy. Hit the like button, subscribe here. Half the people who watch these videos are not even subscribed. Just go and subscribe, takes you a split second. All our information is down below in the description. Thank you guys so much for watching, and until next time.
Peace.
Oh, that's my cue to stop the video. Here we go.
Hopefully this is the last time you'll hear this ad. Because with Chime checking account features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, and getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit, you can probably treat yourself to an ad-free upgrade to spend more time listening to your favorite podcasts, or at least grab yourself an extra morning latte this month. Join millions of Chime members who work on their financial progress with fee-free overdraft and no monthly fees. When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals easier and still have the occasional treat. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. That's chime.com/goals24. Chime. Feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.